Start with 2 minutes of meditation, and then I'll lead everyone in a prayer. Actually, Bill, will you lead us in a prayer?
Yeah. All right, guys, please.
After meditation.
No, you're good. So meditation starts now.
Opportunity to be recreated in a new way of life. I thank you for bringing these alumni to us safely, for their word and their message, that they bear witness to your power. God, I ask you to use Tarek and Brandon this morning as a hollow bone for your power to flow through out of them and into this room. God, I ask you to open ears that are closed. For those doors that are cracked open, I ask you to kick that door open this morning. We honor you as we walk this new way of life on this path to get closer to you, Father. I ask these things in your name. God, thanks for being here with us this morning. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, this one's called Perseverance. Invisible lines. The fisherman repairs his net and his fish are nearly caught. The fisherman does not have the properly repaired nets, then his trip is useless. Preparation is a major part of his endeavor. Only when the fisherman keeps his nets intact, keeps his boat repaired, and studies the condition of the fish in the water, does going out to fish become a mere formality. Then fish fall into his hands as if guided by invisible lines. When it seems as if nothing encouraging is happening to us, it is important to remember such perseverance. Work may be drudgery. Maintaining a home may be routine. We may find our goals quite distant. But we must persevere and prepare nevertheless. That will bring a steady pace towards our goals, buoy our faith in rough and threatening times. To taste the fruit of perseverance requires maturity and experience. We need to cultivate patience, planning, and timing. We build our resources even when circumstances seem to be against us. We don't neglect anything we have set in motion. If we nurse our plans through good times and bad, our plans will eventually succeed with inevitability of fish caught in a net. I know that we've got people kind of all over the spectrum in terms of new to a lot of time. And a lot of what we're talking about up here seems like it's daunting and impossible. And how am I ever going to take anybody through the steps and be of any use to them? But what you find is that when you do preparation, when you do the work yourself, you do the meditation, you do the prayer, you submit yourself to the process, this mysterious force shows up in your life that gives you a knowing that you say the right things, do the right things, you are the right person. And so Tarek and I, after doing this for a while, we've done the prep work. We've done the preparations to get us to the point where we can submit or transmit a message to you. But really, most of what you're experiencing from us is just, this is just natural. We're just doing what we're doing. There's no script. There's no, we sometimes have to talk about, like, well, are you going to cover this? Or because we don't know. We're in the flow of things. We're in the flow of life. And you can too if you guys just pay attention. Because if you pay attention, life's always got it figured out for you. You just need to get in the flow.
Thanks, Brandon. We all turn to page 11 in your big books. So last night we did a pretty thorough examination using our experience of powerlessness, physical powerlessness, mental powerlessness. I threw out all those questions to identify what you were truly powerless over and what led you down that path to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, the relationship with which substance. And we looked at the bedevilments and we looked at unmanageability. And so there's not a lot of hope in that first step. Actually, there's no hope in the first step. So one of the responsibilities that Brandon and I have this weekend is bearing witness. We use our experience as a testimony that this process works. And so Ebby came to Bill in a form of witness. And he says on page 11, "But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead. Suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. In order to be raised from the dead, you have to go through a rebirth process." And so there are so many important questions to ask when you're going through this process. We talked about one last night, and it was, do you want to live? You know, how free do you want to be? Do you want to breathe? I have a question for you. Are you willing to die in order to live? Because the big books just made a casual reference to that. Turn to page 14. Simple. First full paragraph. Simple, but not easy. A price has to be paid. It means destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who resides over us all. So when I see the word destruction, when something is destroyed, it ceases to exist. And if we have to go through a process of destruction, certain things about us have to cease to exist, or at least that has to be the goal. And again, I'm going to imply here that there's a death process involved. So I'm going to read something out of another book. Besides the fear of pain, there's another fear which has to be faced on the path of spiritual evolution, the fear of death. Every new form is born out of a dying old one. That's what we're striving here for, God, is a new form. A new way of life implies a new form. You're going to embody life differently. This process of dying to live is represented by organic life. Inorganic matter becomes organic by dying to itself and living a higher life in the plant, and so can the plant be exalted into still higher life by dying unto itself and living in the animal. The whole course of evolution is an illustration of the principle of dying to live. Can the seeker easily give up the old organs in order to acquire new ones? Can he learn to surrender to the demand, die before you die, die inside your life and go on living? It's a paradox. Advocates a spiritual saint, paradoxically. His view of death as a prerequisite for birth encompasses the whole range of possibilities open to him who desires to live as a true human being, the soul of which a one knows no limits. In verses often quoted, he says, "I died as a mineral and became a plant. I died as plant and rose to animal. I died as animal and I was man. Why should I fear? When was I less by dying? Yet once more I shall die as man to soar with angels blessed. But even from angelhood I must pass on. All except God do perish. When I have sacrificed my angel soul, I shall become what no mind ever conceived. Oh, let me not exist, for non-existence proclaims in organ tones, to him, the great one, we shall return. The spirit and the soul ascend the ladder of spiritual evolution with the power of love. On every step, it is reminded of the vast, free space of home where the beloved, our great spirit, abides. The remembrance of the old, forgotten taste of the homeland, the real homeland, gives the spirit and the soul the courage to die to the known and to leap into the unknown. The lament of separation then turns into a song of jubilation." And that's what terrifies us the most, is we have done something for such a long time that what's on the other side is so uncertain and so unknowable, and we fall victim to a delusion that it's unattainable, that we refuse and we hold on to that past with all our might, and we will not let go of it. But this process of dying, if you read any spiritual text, it's in there. Any of the traditions, it doesn't matter what tradition we're talking about, there's this concept of dying inside this life, going through the truly the annihilation of all things worthwhile, which leaves you knowing the only thing that will never fail is a relationship with a God of your understanding. Only thing that won't fail you. Everything else in life ultimately at some point will fail. Money, relationships, cars, jobs, everything will ultimately fail. The big book. The big book even says we cannot read inspirational books. It's not about just reading the big book. It's not about worshiping the big book. It's about practicing the way of life described in the big book. And there's constantly stories about individuals letting go. And the letting go process, I believe, is a death process. And as sponsors, not only do we need to ask you the important question of do you want to live, but are you willing to die? Certain things about us have to die. The main thing, in my opinion, is this idea that my way works, my ideas work. That has to slowly begin to die. And that's why it's so effortless and enjoyable to work with individuals who have come to the rooms with the death already intact. You know how you can identify them? They don't argue. They don't debate. They usually go, "Yes, sir, I'll do that." And they call you like really shortly after you've given out the assignment. They say, "Hey, I'm done. I'm ready to go to the next one." Right? That's how you identify those individuals. But most of us that show up here do not fit that description. We don't. Big book says it, though. What price are you willing to pay? Because I think it involves certain things about your personality and your character must die. And I think it's just acknowledging the belief in that is the catalyst for the process. But most do not acknowledge the belief that that is necessary. And that's what we're talking about here. I have a man that I spent some time with a few years ago, and he made a statement several times while I was with him about, you know, one of the things that appalled him after being sober for 40 years was the amount of things he's had to say to himself, man, I believed that for a long time, but now it's not true anymore, so I'm going to choose to believe something new. Well, that's a death process there. That's a letting go process. And that's part of this spiritual process, the 12-step process. Hopefully being crushed by your own personal crisis that you can't postpone or evade, you'll be able to fearlessly face that proposition as well. Because that's, I think, one of the things we have to come to believe. I think that's all.
Good for now. Page 19. Three lines up from the bottom. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and the respect for their opinions and attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers or drug addicts depend upon constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. You guys want to see your current universe transform instantly? If everybody in this room changes their mind, that looks at that last statement of your life depends on your constant thought of others and how you may meet their needs. If everybody in this room switches that focus to trying to meet the needs of others, there's going to be like a rainbow bomb take off in this room, because everybody, like, do you realize if everybody thought about everybody else all the time, how just this collective universe would absolutely transform? Let me get that for you. No, let me get that for you. Let me help you there. I mean, like you, the efficiency of this place would go up at least tenfold. The recovery rate of this would be 1,000,000%. The problem is that for so many people, that thought of others first is so contrary. Because we've always learned that we must fight to get what we need. We have to exert ourselves, right? Contrary. And then this next paragraph. So, Tarek talked about the difference between recovered and recovering, and it seems like there's a lot of people that just think that we're always going to be suffering is the way that they say that they're always going to be recovering. I love when people challenge me within the rooms of AA that we can get to a recovered state of mind and body, because this paragraph here, you may have already asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking or using. Doubtless you are curious to discover the how and the why. In the face of the expert opinion to the contrary, even within the rooms of AA or CA or any of the other fellowships, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body, right? So, contrary to what other people say, well-meaning people that have much of their own knowledge, if you believe that you are in recovered state, you probably are headed that direction if you're not already there. If you believe that you're going to always suffer and be sick, and you're going to stand behind your disease, then you are going to always be sick and have to stand behind your disease. Henry Ford, if you believe something is true or it is not, you're right. If you believe that the steps don't work, you will do everything in your power to prove that point. If you believe the steps work, you will do everything in your power to prove that point. If you believe somebody's a jerk, you will do everything in your power to prove that that person's a jerk. If you believe that everybody really has a good part of them, and if you look to find it, guarantee you, you will find it. So on page 23, our book shifts from the physical to the mental. We've already talked some about the mental, but like, isn't it clear to you guys that everybody else thinks this is just some sort of like decision, right? Because if we know that every time we put a substance into our body, we go off running and we don't stop for sometimes days, then when you guys leave here, you're good, right? When people say to you in meetings, don't drink no matter what, don't use no matter what, cool. The problem for me is I drink no matter what. This idea of putting the plug in the drug, can't do that. I've never learned. Because something always takes me back. So on page, it therefore, the problem centers in the mind, right? So how do I treat that? How do I treat that thing that constantly takes me back? Where do you want to go? Because we've heard some of this.
You want me to explain what?
Yeah.
If I were to spend any time with any of you one-on-one and we talk about loss of control, I bet it'd be very easy for each of you to look at your experience and see once I start off that's wrong. Is that a safe assumption? Okay. I think the most misunderstood pages in our big book are pages 23 to 43. Because they talk about the states of mind preceding the relapse. I know everybody understands that the relapse happens way before the drugs and the alcohol re-enter the system. But getting an alcoholic and a drug addict to see that they don't have any choice in a state of consciousness called sobriety is really difficult. Most may nod their head and say, I get it, but intellectually it's hard to grasp. What are you talking about? I didn't choose to relapse. I didn't have any drugs in my body, and I chose to relapse. I wanted to get high. I wanted to get a drink more than I wanted to stay sober. Well, yes and no. So let's look at page 24. The fact is, for most alcoholics and addicts, for reasons they don't understand, they have lost the power of choice or the power to choose their drinking and their using. My so-called willpower became practically non-existent. I was unable, and these are the words you need to circle and highlight at certain times, to bring into my mind or my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of all the horrible stuff that happened the last time and the depths of insanity and almost death that I went to. So I can't bring the memory of those things and the humiliation that was part of those experiences. I can't bring those memories of even a week or a month ago or last night. I gave the example of the hotel that I left, and then later on that day in the evening, I'm back at it again. So a few hours, I'm without defense against the first drink or drug. So let's give you a real example of this. So let's. I was notorious for hitting the bar on Thursday night, ending up downtown Atlanta on Thursday night, skipping work on Friday, smoking all through the weekend, and maybe Sunday I'd eventually make it back to my house to finally crash because I got to get up to work Monday morning. And so maybe I get some sleep. Or maybe it's one of those times where I still smoke all through Sunday into the morning hours on Monday, and I eat a Xanax bar or Klonopin, I chain smoke a bunch of cigarettes, I pace around the house, I finally take a shower, I drive to work, I'm tweaking. I go by the receptionist, trying not to make eye contact. I'm trying to get to my office, which has a door on it, thank God. And I can go to my office, close the door, put do not disturb on the phone, and try to chill out. So by 10 o'clock, I'm not tweaking anymore. Okay? So 10 o'clock, I open the door. I take do not disturb on the phone. I sit down. I'm trying to work. Look like dog shit, but I'm still at work. And I start to tell myself, you know what? Okay, I'm going to take a break. All right, I'm just going to chill until Friday, and I don't have enough money left. I owe my roommate Kevin money for some bills. Maybe my mom's birthday is coming up. Maybe I got some important event I've got to do this week, right? I need to chill. By 11:30, all of a sudden, all I can see is a big 20 rock on the end of a stem, and I'm just in slow motion, like, boom, the torch goes up, and I'm feeling that first blast, and then all of a sudden, I'm like, no. So I'm going through an intellectual sorting out process. I see the 20 rock on the end of the stem, and I start to play the tape through. And I'm like, I can't do it. Okay, I'm going to go back to my work. And it goes away. That's an intellectual sorting out process. Well, see, something around 12:30 or 1, it happens again. Right? It's coming for me again. And I do the same intellectual sorting out process. And what I mean by that is I'm thinking it through. I'm like, no, this is not a good idea. Sounds like I'm making a choice, does it not? Absolutely. By 3:30, I get a text message from my boy down on the block. He says he's got something for me. And then it starts up again, and I'm trying to fight it. I'm fighting it, and I can't do it. I don't have the money. I've got all these wonderful reasons for not going back that day. So I think I'm in the clear, right? I've had access to my willpower throughout the course of the day. 5 o'clock comes, I get into my car in the parking garage, no thought of it at all. All of a sudden, I'm creeping up to this intersection. And the intersection, I go left, I go downtown, I go straight, I go home. And so that process that I had access to all day long, which was examining my options and either accepting them or rejecting them, which is a denial. Denial is to reject, right? So, I pull up to the light, and the next thing I know, I'm downtown. And I set the terrible cycle in motion. I didn't make a choice. I just went. See, we always think that we make a choice because we go. That's not true. A true choice involves an examination of your options and either an acceptance or a rejection. Right? I got up this morning. I had a few shirts at the hotel. I looked at what shirt I wanted to put on. I looked at the shorts I had on and either accepted or rejected. That's a choice. Right? When I got to that light, I had no access to that process. That's what the book is saying. At certain times, I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory. My willpower is practically non-existent. And the thing that really fascinates me about all of this as I'm talking about it is the fact that in the rooms of AA, and I bet you even here at the Bridges, there's the word denial is thrown around all the time. Do you guys realize alcoholics and addicts, when it comes to the relationship with alcohol and drugs, we don't suffer from denial? We suffer from delusion. Denial implies a choice. It's a rejection. We can't see. We can't tell the difference between what's true and false. The big book authors don't even use the word denial in the first 164, except on page, I believe, let's see here. It's where Bill's talking to his father. Yes, page 10. He's talking about with his grandfather, his insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's light, his rejection of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen.
But even in that case, it's his grandfather's denial, not the alcoholic's denial.
Yes. Only time that word's used in our big book, in the first 164 pages. But they use words like obsession, illusion, and I can't tell
delusion.
The difference. Delusion, and I can't tell the difference between what's true and false. So, if all of us are going to face the red light scenario, how the hell do you know when your red light scenario is going to show up?
Well, and even still, like, I can't tell you how many times I sit across from a guy and we start looking at this at certain times. And they want to recall some distant memory of a time when it worked. All right, so tell me, how your drinking was at the end. He said, "Yeah, well, I drank too much at the end." Okay, so you didn't have control over the amount. Yeah, but back in high school, I could drink a six pack and put it down. Yeah, okay, but we're talking about at the end. But back in high school, he wants to keep, and so the mind does this funny thing where it takes us back to this period where it did work. Because this disease, this illness is progressive, is the closer we get to the end, like, that window, like, when was the first time that you started seeing things and hearing things? How long into your years of smoking crack did that happen?
Prior 2 years.
Two years?
2.5 years.
And at the end, how often was it happening?
Almost every time. So guys, what used to take me 4 or 5 days of staying up, sleep deprivation, smoking crack, and then the shadow people would show up, and then I would start hearing voices, and then I would have my psychotic breaks. Near the end, I could be smoking for 30 minutes, and I was starting to hear voices. I think a lot of people probably get what I'm talking about.
And so when you're taking a guy through his experience sitting across from him as a sponsor, that stuff's great. It's part of your story. It helps you identify, but like what was going on at the end? How was that? Because that's what we need to be looking at. We don't need to look at the 2 or 3 instances over the last 5 years where you had 2 beers and you went home. We need to be looking at what happens the majority of the time. When you start, do you stop? Okay? So who in here... Now, we've got these... You know, we hear change people, places, and things, right? Stay away from those things, those places, those people. So, who in here drank or used when they had a girlfriend? Who in here drank or used when they didn't have a girlfriend? Who in here drank and used when they had a job? How about when they didn't have a job? Who drank or used when things were going well? When things were going bad? Sunny days? Rainy days? Days with football games? Days without football games? Watching NASCAR? Not watching NASCAR? Fishing? Not fishing? So guys, when do we drink and use? So, what the hell is the triggers list going to do for me? I don't know about you guys. You can look at your own experience. But the thing that Brandon has identified as a trigger is oxygen. When I breathe, I want to drink. Until power's been inserted that I don't have control of. So... look at your own experience. Like, I was fascinated, literally I was fascinated the first time I was able to light a grill and did not have a beer in my hand. Because I was taught, somebody asked my dad one time, how long do you let the grill warm up? And he said, 2 beers. And they said, well, what if you're drinking it slow? He goes, it's still 2 beers. I overheard that, immediately took it as truth. Every time I light a grill, I'm going to have 2 beers, or 6, you know, depends. Smoking meat was great, because I had to tend to the fire, right? If you're in front of the fire, what do you have to do? Drink. Can't tell you how many times I'd go downstairs, light the grill, put the meat on, come upstairs, and my wife would look at me and go, what happened to you downstairs? Maybe they were burgers. You know, take 10 minutes to grill, right? I'd come up just schnockered, and she'd be like, what do you do? She was confused. Normal person went downstairs. Completely insane person showed back up. It's like a magic box.
Back to you. So that was a wonderful description of our loss of power, the ability to make a choice, and our loss of control. So we have to go to this place that requires the surrender that I spoke about last night, and the surrender cannot be worked. It's something that you experience. So the big book gives a few descriptions, so I want to read some of them. Page 6. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. Brandon sitting on that back porch, on some level, now I know the birds were louder, the air was crisper, something was brighter, but I'm willing to bet if he looked, there was some bewilderment. There's a bewilderment there, because not only is he experiencing the light and the birds and the sun, but he's also experiencing remorse, the horror of the last night of standing outside that room that he could not walk into where the gun was, and the hopelessness of that morning. Both. The courage to do battle was not there. The brain raced uncontrollably, and there was this terrible sense of impending calamity. This was my experience on so many of those mornings in those hotel rooms. It was the experience where I thought people were coming into my house, and I was hiding in boxes with my crack stem and my cell phone so nobody would find me. Okay, this, he always laughs when I talk about that, but remorse, horror, and hopelessness, right? Do you have that in your experience? Then page 8. Actually, let's start at the bottom of page 7. It's a really good debate. You know, no one needs to tell us. We know and almost welcome the idea that we're going to die. It's a devastating blow to our pride. We, who had thought so well of ourselves and our abilities and of our capacity to surmount obstacles, were cornered at last. Now we're to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of drunkards and addicts who have gone on before. I thought of my girlfriend or my family or my close friends. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that is over now. I wonder who's sitting in here has that going on. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Crack cocaine was my master. So those are descriptions. If you search your experience, you most likely will find them. But then you got to ask yourself, well, what am I willing to do at this point? Now I stand at the turning point, and the turning point's rooted in a genuine surrender. And so, let's see here. Idols must be smashed. When the spiritual traveler experiences a state of rage and frustration and self-pity, when he cannot go on with the regular routine of his life, with idly surrendering to the tyranny of the circumstances he sees in his life, when he has reached a point of no return, when he feels the time has come to risk that which has been taken for granted, then, provided that the time is right, God inserts his power. When despair becomes greater than fear of the unknown, it is God who intervenes and comes to our aid to remove the obstacles in our path. This ever-present life force gives the spiritual seeker strength to change the direction of his life. But see, we have to have a certain acknowledgement here. Yes, I need to die in order to live. Well, how do I find out if I need to die? I start looking at my experience and see how I've already gone to the gates of insanity or death. And as a result of the way I want to live, my ideas are always the best. I refuse to put other people first. You know, my attitude and respect for others' opinions and shortcomings, I don't believe have anything to do with me being useful to them. Am I willing to drop that, let go of that, let that die, and say, you know what? My constant thought of others is going to be my daily practice. How can I help meet someone else's needs? And this is what we're talking about here. Dying in this life in order to live. It's part of our first step. It's a both and. You want to live and you want to die. The death I'm talking about is the death of your way of doing things. The death of self that the program requires. Right? Later on in the book, they're going to talk about no one likes the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, and the confession of shortcomings that the process requires for successful consummation. To me, that's all letting go. You have to see. And in order to see, the veil has to be removed. In order for the veil to be removed so we can see, our way of doing things has to die. You're all sitting at the bridges of hope. All of us, every single one of us, because at some point in our life, we refused to die that death. My ideas and the way I looked at the world were the be-all and the end-all, they were the alpha and the omega. My reasoning was God. That's why I earned the chair. I bet that's true for every single person within this room.
So, page 36. Bottom of the page. Thus started one more journey to the asylum, to the bridges of hope. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, nothing for the intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always, or using always, caused. You may have much knowledge about yourself as an alcoholic or an addict, yet all reasons for not drinking or using were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea, insert any one of your excuses. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? Lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. That's how our book identifies insanity. So, you hear us say this over and over again. If we go to page 42, this is what we hope to convey to you over the course of the weekend. Middle of the page, two of the members, Tarek and Brandon, came to see us at the Bridges of Hope. They grinned, which we didn't like so much. Then they asked you if you thought yourself an alcoholic or an addict, and if you were really licked this time. Hopefully you have to concede on both propositions. Over the course of the weekend, Tarek and Brandon will pile on you heaps of evidence to the effect that the alcoholic or addict mentality, such as you exhibited before your last run, was a hopeless condition. Brandon and Tarek will cite cases out of their own experience by the dozen. We hope that this will snuff out the last flicker of conviction that you can do the job yourself. Then Tarek and Brandon are going to outline the spiritual answer and the program of action contained within the book, Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Though you may fancy yourself a churchman, our proposals will not be intellectually hard to swallow, but the program of action, though it seems entirely sensible, you'll see is pretty drastic. It will mean that you will have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. Death to self. That will not be easy for you. But the moment that you make up your mind to go through with the process, you will find this inner knowing that you will just use as a motivating factor for the rest of your life. You will learn that the spiritual principles will solve all your problems. Not just some of them, but all of your problems. Then you will be brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying, and we hope, more useful than the life you lived before. Death to self. Although your old manner of living may not have been a bad one, you will someday know that the best moments from the past can't hold a candle to your existence now. That's why you'll hear me talk about, and you will continue to hear me talk about, the fact that I believe in some cosmic way my life was spliced onto a different life, because the other than the people that are in my old life, parents, mother of my children, the fact that my resume still holds up today, my old life and my current life do not resemble each other at all. I do not understand, this is not a place of judgment, I do not understand people that say they want their old life back. I did not. I want a completely new one. I went to sleep one day, I got a new one, I didn't know it. But that's what happened for me. If that sounds interesting to you, keep listening. If that doesn't sound interesting to you, maybe we'll see you back here next year. I don't know. I don't know where we at.
Somewhere around there. So we've hammered home this first step. I don't know if we can go much deeper than we have gone. Now, the big book's an interesting... And it's an interesting textbook because it tells you what it's about to tell you, then it tells it to you, and then it tells it to you again. And it's very repetitive, and it's very redundant because they knew we were a bunch of knuckleheads, and they were going to tell us over and over in many different ways because they needed to shed light on the problem. And we are, since our skulls are so thick, it works really well with us, right? To spend a lot of time hammering home one concept. How many pages? For powerlessness?
For powerlessness?
54, I think.
Yeah.
54 pages.
53,
54 pages devoted to one concept. Powerlessness.
So, what does the first step say? So, if you're powerless over alcohol and drugs... Doesn't that imply forever? Yeah. And you notice there's two parts to that. How many people in here thought that just because their life was chaos, their life was unmanageable, that it was because of the drugs and alcohol? Who stopped doing the drugs and the alcohol and their life was still chaos? Yeah. Must be something else going on here, right? Let me hit this and then
last question real quick. Who in here believes that when you lose power, when you're stripped of power, you're also stripped of control? So power, you lose power, you lose control. Okay.
Because isn't choice a power?
So that's the next question. Do you believe that once you lose power, you also lose choice? No. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Who in here believes that after you work the 12 steps, God's going to give you the power to choose? I hear it a lot in meetings, but today I have a choice. So my deal is, how can you admit powerlessness back here, and then all of a sudden over here, you say you have a choice, but when you guys told me that you lost power, you lose control, you lose choice, it would imply if you have a choice today that now you have the power. And my question is always this: what kind of God would give you a choice over something that might kill you? Wouldn't he just take it away altogether so you don't have to even choose anymore? Wouldn't he put you in a position of neutrality, safe and protected? And that's what our big book promises. It says the problem will be removed. The problem is that the illusion that I ever had a choice. That's what kept me out there for so long, because I thought I was choosing over and over and over. I didn't realize that I lost power, choice, and control. And once I knew that, I saw how fucked I was in the first step. And now the question is, what am I willing to do to unfuck myself? What are you willing to do to unfuck yourself? Because that's what the rest of the book is about.
Good. So, hopefully you feel a little bit crushed by your experience just through our conversation. Back to page 25. So, what we're going to present to you is the following. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires, demands for its successful consummation. 25. But I suspect that you're seeing that it really worked in others, Tarek, Brandon, and the speakers that you have here this weekend. And hopefully you will come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of the life as you've been living it. So, when, therefore, you were approached by those who the problem has been solved, there was nothing left for you to do but pick up this simple kit of spiritual tools laid at your feet, and then you will find much of heaven and be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, which you had never dreamed of because you've never been there. You know, it's impossible to explain an experience that you've never had. Who in here has ever gone skydiving? Okay, so those of you who haven't gone skydiving, can you tell me what skydiving's like? Why not? So explain it to me. But see, exactly what... There's so many people that want to tell you what living the spiritual path looks like that have never lived the spiritual path. But for somebody to try to explain jumping out of an airplane that's never jumped out of an airplane, and I continue to ask you that question, you're probably thinking, does this guy not hear? Like, I can't explain that. But yeah, we know what the spiritual realm is going to look like, right? We know what the fourth dimension is going to look like. We know what life without drugs and alcohol is going to look like, don't we? How can you? You've never been there before. It's so interesting to me the amount of knowledge that we acquire from somewhere, from people that have no knowledge about, you know, it's fascinating to me. Most of what I learned growing up about how to treat women, I learned from men who have no idea how to treat women. And then when I had crappy relationships, I couldn't figure out why, because I was following the directions from the people that told me how to do it. But I had no experience with actually having a true relationship with a woman. So I'm sure that there's a lot of people in this room that have had all sorts of people tell them how to have a relationship with something, God, by people that maybe are just reading something or restating something that they heard from somebody else but have never had the experience. Because what we're talking about here is experience with that power. Not just words. Actual experience. Taking you through the steps that it's necessary to put that backpack on with your parachute in it and actually jump and have a successful landing. I don't want to go to somebody that doesn't know what they're talking about. I don't want to go to somebody that just reads words out of a book. I want to go to somebody who actually has successfully done that. The great fact is just this and nothing less. Tarek and Brandon have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized their whole attitude towards life, towards their fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty, not just kind of, absolute certainty, that whatever created all this has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. That has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do.
Thanks, I got the stopping place. All right, we're going to come back a quarter after.
Yeah.